The next, the first case up is Eflin versus the People, and we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Catherine Bryan. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Eflin. Mr. Eflin is not present today because he is currently incarcerated in the Department of Corrections, where he has been for the past 4 years. I would like to notify this court that numerous members of his family are here in support of him, including Marna Arnett, who was a witness at the motion hearing, at the trial, and at the sentencing hearing, and his sister Carolyn. What I would like to do today is briefly set forth the issues. I'm going to summarize those, not read them to the court. I know that you probably have them in front of you. Then briefly do a summary of the facts. The facts are set forth in detail in my opening brief, and it spans numerous pages, I think about 40. I anticipate being able to summarize those facts in hopefully about 4 minutes, and then I will take each of the separate four arguments in turn. I'd like to reserve approximately 10 minutes for my rebuttal argument, as I am curious and anxious to hear what the state has to say and would need an opportunity to respond to that. The issue before the court, and again this is summarized, is whether the Court of Appeals erroneously affirmed the district court's denial of Mr. Eflin's motion to suppress statements on four different grounds. One, because the interrogating officers failed to advise him of his Miranda rights, and this turns on whether or not he was in custody. Two, because whether or not he was in custody, Mr. Eflin invoked his right to remain silent and his right to counsel, and the interrogating officers told him that based on advice from the 18th Judicial District Attorney, he was not entitled to counsel at that time. Three, whether the statements were voluntary, and four, whether there was prosecutorial misconduct by the district attorney's actions in advising the interrogating officers that Mr. Eflin was not entitled to counsel. I noted this in my brief, and I do want to point out to the court that the issues were reworded, and they are not the way that I presented them. And really, the only reason I'm saying that is because in the second issue, it injects the word proactively. I certainly respect and understand this court is has authority to change the issues and reword them. I do not know if the use of that word had any legal or other significance for whoever wrote that. That is not my word, and I think it begs the question. It is my position that it was not a proactive move because Mr. Eflin was trying to stop an interrogation that was then occurring. Okay, the facts of this case arise from a situation that in July of 2005, Mr. and Mrs. Eflin and their adult daughter, Brenna, who all suffer from mental illnesses, were being evicted from their rental home due to failure to pay. Mr. and Mrs. Eflin were able to find somewhere to live. Unfortunately, no one was willing to take Brenna, who suffered from bipolarism with psychotic features. So having nowhere for their adult daughter to go, they are unaware of anywhere for her to go. The family agreed together to commit suicide. This was undisputed below. This has never been a case where people are saying that was simply a theory of defense. It was at trial recognized that all three people had intended and wanted to commit suicide. Mr. Eflin was subsequently charged. He survived and was subsequently charged with first degree murder of his wife and aiding suicide, a class 4 felony of his daughter. Ms. Eflin died, and so did Brenna. Brenna died from a drug overdose. The cause of death was somewhat disputed at trial. Ms. Eflin had a lethal dosage of narcotics in her system, but the coroner testified the actual cause of death was a gunshot wound to her head. Okay. On August 1st, Marna Arnett notified the police and asked the police to do a welfare check on her family because she had been unable to contact them. The police responded to the scene. No way am I challenging that. Search and seizure. The police enter. Well, before they enter, they find the eviction notice on the front door, a suicide notice attached to the back door signed by all three people, Mr. and Mrs. Eflin and Brenna. They enter the house. Inside the house, they locate Brenna, deceased, on the couch, Mrs. Eflin, deceased, in a chair. Another suicide notes, all three of their IDs and a map where they wanted their assets to be taken across sort of a little shrine area also in the family room. There were numerous pill bottles throughout the family area. There was a gun on the sofa, and Mr. Eflin was located on the floor in a bedroom. He was incoherent at this time, babbling unintelligible words. The police handcuffed him and removed him from the home. Officer Sheets, who was the lead detective, arrived, finds Mr. Eflin outside, goes with Mr. Eflin in an ambulance to the hospital. She testifies he was not cuffed or no legal restraints in the ride to the hospital. This is now on August 1st. So on August 1st, that happens, and he's in the emergency room. And Officer Sheets orders a blood draw, which I'm also not challenging, though that was challenged below. The district court found there was probable cause to believe crime had been committed and that it was supported by exigent circumstances. After this happens, Officer Sheets leaves, and he testifies there was no officer stationed at that time when he leaves the area on the 1st. This is contradicted by Officer Antia's testimony, which is he was sent there. He testifies he believes his recollection is the night when Mr. Eflin came, and he relieved another officer who was already present. In any event, it doesn't matter because everybody agrees Officer Antia is present on the 2nd. And on the 2nd, he is sitting outside Mr. Eflin's hospital room, which has two solid walls, a glass wall into the hallway that has a curtain. The door was open, and Officer Antia sat in uniform and armed, his weapon was visible, in a chair outside Mr. Eflin's room. He testifies that he could see Mr. Eflin. He never left his perch, and he believed that Mr. Eflin could see him. The state disputes this in the answer brief. It is set forth in my opening brief, the pages where this occur, but I would draw your attention to page 115 of the transcript. 114, the last line is, defense counsel asked, so all he was able to see was you sitting out there armed and in uniform. The answer is right. So I don't actually think that's a contested fact. Then Officer Antia testified he was sent there, and he first, this is a quote, said, they said just make sure he doesn't leave the hospital area. That's his original quote. Upon further cross-examination, and this is by defense counsel because he was a defense witness at this hearing. Upon subsequent questioning, he then says, this is a quote, apparently, if Mr. Eflin was able to get up and leave there, he could, I suppose. So first he sent there to make sure he doesn't leave. Then he says he supposes he could if he was able to. Of course, he was not able to on that date in any event. On the 2nd, Officer Sheets and Hodgkins go to the hospital in the morning. When they're there at that time, Officer Antia tells them doctors had indicated Mr. Eflin was on dialysis, incoherent and not able to talk, and suggested they come back in the afternoon. Meanwhile, Deputy District Attorney Dan May comes to the hospital sometime between this and an afternoon interrogation, and sometime during the course of that day, or possibly on the 3rd, again, it doesn't matter, it's prior to the interrogation, which is on the 3rd, but sometime on the 2nd, Officer Sheets, Marna Arnett both testify there is a meeting between both officers, Dan May and herself, in a conference room at the hospital. Ms. Arnett testifies that she informed all of them, Deputy District Attorney Dan May, both officers, that she had talked to Mr. Eflin about securing the services of an attorney. She also indicated that she was going to contact Victims' Rights Assistance Coordinator for referrals. The officers indicate that this did happen on the 2nd, and the conference in the meeting at the hospital happened with Dan May, but they do not know and could not recall, in particular, if Mr. May was present at the very time that Ms. Arnett said she was attempting to secure services for Mr. Eflin. Meanwhile, I have a meeting at the sheriff's office on the same day, which is August 2nd, and Officer Sheets testifies, regardless of what happened at the conference, the officers notified, there were three deputy district attorneys present at that time, Dan May, Eva Wilson, and David Jones. And there is a discussion, and they say things according to things like Mr. Eflin's right to counsel, whether he needs to be Mirandized, and they advise them that Marna Arnett had told them she talked to his father, he did not wish to talk to them, and he was in the process of securing counsel. According to both Officer Hodgkins and Officer Sheets, Deputy District Attorney Dan May told them that he was not entitled to legal counsel at that time. The officers go back, and that meeting was perhaps on the 2nd and possibly the morning of the 3rd, again, definitely before the interrogation, because that advice is repeated to Mr. Eflin, so it doesn't really matter if it's the 2nd or the 3rd. In the afternoon of the 2nd, the officers return back to the hospital, attempt to make contact with Mr. Eflin. Marna is present at that time in the room with him. When Marna is present, Mr. Eflin, who is distraught at that time, who has just learned he survived, his family's dead, tells the officers he doesn't want to talk to them at that time. Both officers indicate that he had testified that he had indicated he might be willing to do so in the future, but he was emotional and he was distraught. They also asked him to sign a medical release at that hearing, not during the challenge interrogation, not hearing at that meeting. Marna is present when Mr. Eflin is told his rights in the presence of his daughter. He declines to sign the medical release waiver. The officers leave. They return the following day. When they hit the hospital parking lot, Marna is present and she is leaving with her husband. She sees the officer. She comes back, asks them what they're doing. They say they're going to talk to Mr. Eflin. She tells the officer she has spoken to Mr. Eflin. He does not wish to talk to them, and she is attempting to secure an attorney for him. They tell her whether or not he wants an attorney will be, and I quote, his decision. Of course, it doesn't later turn out to be that way, but that is what they tell Marna. Marna follows the officers back inside. They both testify to this. She asks to be present during the interrogation of her father. The officers do not allow this. They tell her they want to talk to him alone. They enter the hospital room, and they shut the door. So, regarding the curtain, they say it was closed, drawn almost all the way. There might have been a crack in it, and now the door is shut. Mr. Eflin is in a hospital bed on the left side. The door is on the right side, and this is not in my brief. I forgot it, but it is in the States. So they are between him and the door, for what that's worth. But bed is on the left side, and that is on page 90 of the transcript. One officer sits by his head on the right side of his bed. The other sits by his feet. They're very close to him, sitting right next to him. When they begin, they do not tell him, unlike the officers in Menhars, that he has a right to remain silent. Rather, they tell him they wish to talk to him about what occurred. And they do ask him, are you willing to talk to us? And when they ask him, he says no. He has does not wish to talk to them, or he may talk to them, but he wishes the presence of an attorney prior to talking to them, and he did not want to talk to them at that time. He also tells them he has talked to his daughter and his sister about securing the services of an attorney. Officer Hodgkin testified, this is a quote from page 150, that it was very clear, and that Mr. Eflin was, quote, trying to see how to get about securing an attorney through both private and court-appointed means. He wasn't contacting the public defender's office. They were out attempting to secure. Use of the word hire appears throughout the transcript as well, in terms of whether Marna said, I'm hiring an attorney, or what it was. It's either way that they could get an attorney. When Mr. Eflin tells them he does not want to talk to them until he has had an opportunity to speak with counsel, the officers ignore that, and Officer Hodgkin says, well, will you at least talk to us about your medical status and your property? According to the officers, he agrees to answer these, or he just does answer them, says give the property to Marna. And regarding his medical status, he says he thinks the hospital may let him go the next day or that day, but he's not sure because he has to have a mental health evaluation before he is released. The testimony is not elaborated upon at the motion hearing. I assume there was a suicide watch on him due to the circumstances of this case. But in any event, he alerts them he cannot leave the hospital until there is a mental health evaluation. Officer Sheets then tells Mr. Eflin, without further ado, that because he is not under arrest, he is not in legal custody, based on the advice of the 18th District Attorney Dan May, he is not, and I quote, entitled to counsel. And another time he says, and I quote, entitled to legal representative at that time. Mr. Eflin is crying. He is emotional. The officer then says, what I'm going to do is tell you what I think the evidence shows and summarize the case to you. Mr. Eflin is just laying there looking at him, according to the testimony. The officer then says he has been at Mr. Eflin's house for 2 days collecting, and they quote, evidence, and he has come to the following theories, which included, but not alone, that all of them had decided to commit suicide. One suicide note was signed by him, one was signed by Mrs. Eflin. Brenna died from a drug overdose, and Mrs. Eflin died from a gunshot wound to her head, and they believe Mr. Eflin shot and killed his wife. Mr. Eflin is crying. He reaches out and touches the officer, which I think is very important because it shows how close the officer was to him. This is not reaching over a conference table. The man is sitting in a chair next to his hospital bed where he's laying down. Yet Mr. Eflin is able to touch his arm. So if you can envision how close, that means he is seated. He touches his arm and he says, all of your surmises are correct, and if you will give me a day or two, I will walk you through it. They do not give him a day or two, and both Officer Sheets and Officer Hodgkin are very clear that when he makes that statement, they knew he was trying to say he did not want to speak to them at that time, but they continue. And this part I'm going to quote because it's, I think, very important to the issues at hand. Officer Hodgkin testified, he, Mr. Eflin, expressed to us that he did not want to talk to us. Well, let me rephrase that. In a very polite manner, he expressed that he was willing to talk to us, that he was open to talking to us, but that prior to speaking with us, he wanted to consult with and or get an attorney. Question. And you understood what he told you about wanting to speak to a lawyer first? Answer. Yes. Question. Did you and Investigator Sheets let him talk to a lawyer before you went ahead and interviewed him? Answer. No. Question. And had, prior to the time of the 3rd, when you actually interviewed Mr. Eflin, had Mr. Eflin previously stated any reluctance to talking to you? Answer. He had indicated that he didn't seem, I guess, physically or emotionally able on the second visit that we were there, but, quote, he was very clear on the 3rd visit, on the 3rd, that he wanted an attorney first. Question. And after he mentioned that he wanted an attorney throughout the course of the discussions with him, he indicated to you a couple of other times and to investigator sheets that he really didn't want to talk anymore. Do you recall that? Yes. Yes. Because throughout this interrogation a couple times, you know, he had made other things saying he wasn't ready or able to talk about it at that time. Nevertheless, the officers continue the interrogation, and Mr. Eflin ultimately confesses and makes incriminating statements that are set forth in the brief, including but not limited to the fact that he divided the medicine among his family members and that he shot Mrs. Eflin at some point in the night when he woke up, realized she was still breathing because he had promised her that he would make sure she died that night. These statements were used against him at trial. After the interrogation on the 3rd, the attorneys go back to the call the district attorney's office, and then they come back to formally arrest Mr. Eflin. And at that time, they advise him of his rights pursuant to Miranda. He does not waive these rights. He does not sign the form. They again ask for him to waive his medical records, patient privilege, and again, he doesn't. I think that's important for the court to understand that this medical records privilege thing comes up on the 2nd when Marna's present and after the challenged interrogation, because the court below sort of used that to say, oh, the statements aren't involuntary here because Mr. Eflin was able to say no about releasing his medical records. And that did not happen during the challenged interrogation. Okay. The standard of review set forth in the brief, I don't believe it's contested.
So, Brian, was he hooked up in any fashion during the statements that he made?
Yes, Your Honor. He was on an IV, and I'm not sure if he was also on other various monitors. He was, yes, they testified he was.
Evidence shows that he was hooked up to an IV, but not other things?
At least an IV and possibly a monitor as well. Okay, my first argument is that Mr. Eflin was...
Was there day and night protection of his room during these 3 days that you just related?
Yes. Yes, and when Officer Antia first comes, he's indicating it is sort of the middle of the night when he gets there, because I think that was sometime in the afternoon, but he's saying he has relieved someone who was already there. And I don't know if he specifically says what time he's there, but it's somehow in the middle of the night, because by the time he comes, he's relieving someone else and he's there in the morning. So that's my inference from that. Mr. Eflin was in custody at the time the statements were made, and the interrogating office failed to advise him of his constitutional rights pursuant to Miranda. I know this court knows Miranda, so I'm not going to repeat those to you. Before Miranda's advisement is required, two prerequisites must be satisfied. The person must be in custody, and the statements must be made by the product of police interrogation. Interrogation was not disputed below here, so that's not an issue for the court. The state conceded that there was an interrogation that took place. The issue before you is whether or not he was in custody. In determining this, there are two discrete inquiries essential to the determination. First, what were the circumstances surrounding the interrogation? And second, given those circumstances, would a reasonable person have felt he or she was not at liberty to terminate the interrogation and leave? So it's two things, not at liberty to terminate the interrogation and leave. Well, he tried to terminate the interrogation, and not only was it ignored, the officers told him he couldn't have counsel. And, you know, even if they're saying he's not in police custody, it is certainly my position that he was, since there's an armed guard sitting outside his door. This entire time, district attorney's offices were, the district attorney was present coming to the hospital, and they were having ongoing meetings with the police at the station. But I think the case that I most is Minhares is probably the most factually similar. Minhares also took place at a hospital, but Minhares was not the patient. So Minhares, the police talked to in a conference room at the hospital and stood between, if memory serves, him and the door.
Ms. O'Brien, that case is a little distinguishable, at least in part, because they drove him up to the hospital. I think it was 2 hours, and then there was a very aggressive questioning by the police officer. So it may be the closest factual scenario we have, but it's not tremendously helpful.
Well, then, we can repeat the factors for you, but I would like to point out, and I would ask this court, if it's been a while, to reread Miranda, because Whether or not it is aggressive and, what we say, mean interrogation, this was an accusatorial interrogation where the police officers accused him of shooting and killing his wife while he is distraught, laying in a hospital bed, depressed, after attempting to kill himself. And in Miranda, they talk about all the factors and all types of police incommunicado interrogations that are disfavored, and some of those include being the nice guy and trying to be sympathetic in order to overbear somebody's will and elicit a conversation, so elicit a confession. It is not only browbeating, yelling that marks whether or not an interrogation was custodial. It is my position under the factors here, given the accusations they are putting on him. He's emotionally distraught. They both interrogate him in a small room behind closed doors. One sits at his heat, one sits at his feet. The tone is confrontational and accusatory. They confront him with their versions, including the belief that he shot his wife, and he did not give the statement in a narrative style. More egregious than Menharis. He's a patient in the ICU at the time after attempting to kill himself. He recently learned his wife and daughter died. That isolated him from others, including his daughter, Marna, who told him that she wanted to be present when they attempted to speak to her father. And he clearly tells them he does not want to speak with them until he consults an attorney. And unlike Menharis, the police officers actually told him that he had a right to remain silent, I don't know if they said right to remain silent, that he did not need to speak to them. That certainly was not only not said here, but not honored here. I believe the interrogation in this case violates the policy and purpose of Miranda, which is to prevent incommunicado interrogation of individuals in a police-dominating atmosphere, resulting in a self-incriminating statement. And in addition, I think it violates the holding of Miranda, because they did not advise or warn him of his constitutional rights. I'm going to move to argument two now because I see my time is rapidly going. On argument two, whether or not Mr. Eflin is in custody at the time of the policing interrogation, he himself invoked his right to remain silent and right to counsel by telling the officer he did not want to talk to them at that time and did not want to talk to them before he had an attorney.
Counsel, can I just interject here? I guess, is it your position that it doesn't matter whether he's in custody or not for the purposes of your second argument?
I believe if he's in custody, he's entitled to a Miranda advisement. So I'm not going to say it doesn't matter at all. You know, that's one way of going. I'm going to say that whether or not he was, under Miranda, certain rights become self-executing. So you don't have to be advised of them. You have to be advised. You don't have to assert them. They become self-executing on their own when you are in custody and subject to an interrogation, which means if someone didn't even know about these rights and didn't know they exist, they attach. The moment someone is subject to a custodial interrogation, officers must advise and obtain a waiver. So whether or not custody is attached, Mr. Eflin asserts his rights, seemingly aware of them, because he says, I don't want to talk to you until I have a police. So he's not given a Miranda advisement, but he himself asserts these two rights. So the question then becomes, is that a meaningless assertion? Can police then, if he's not in custody, totally and completely not only fail to honor, this is not a scrupulously honored case, they completely ignore, and not only completely ignore, actually tell him he is not entitled to counsel. So this case is unlike others that I have seen. There are none in the nation that I can find, not by the United States Supreme Court.
Now, is that a breach of the attorney's the prosecutor's oath, the ethics, as well as a misstatement of the law?
Correct.
Okay.
I believe so, Your Honor. And I'm not going to be able to read you right now all of the rules cited in the brief, but I think the most telling is the comment to ABA Standard 3.31, which is the investigative function of the prosecution. So this is the investigative function. This isn't during trial.
Right.
And it says, prosecutors, as representatives of the people and upholding all of the laws, must take the lead in assuring that investigations of criminal activities are conducted lawfully and in full and grudging accordance with the safeguards of the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights existed centuries before Miranda. And our forefathers and ancestors not only fought feverishly to establish and defend these rights, they died for them. And 50 years after Miranda and Escobedo, all of these cases begin in the 1950s. First Spano, it's not cited in my brief, doesn't matter, but it's was deciding incommunicado interrogations under voluntariness.
Well, I was trying to get at this is the state inserting itself in a inherently coercive fashion here for the purpose of purposely extracting this confession.
Yes.
I mean, that's the position you're taking here.
Yes, that's my position.
Could I back us up just one second? You went by kind of quickly. So what was the right that was violated?
I believe his 5th, 6th, and 14th rights.
Let me pin you down just to answer. You started off saying we knew about Miranda. So is it your argument that even if he is not in custody, the Miranda privilege applies? Is that the argument?
No, my argument is He has a Fifth Amendment right to remain silent and a right to counsel. He has a Sixth Amendment under right to counsel. Colorado constitutional sites as well, 16th and 18th, and he had a due process 14th Amendment that attached all at this time. And I understand, Your Honor, that at most of the right to counsel cases, attachment adversarial proceedings have begun. However, I don't believe this issue has ever been resolved by the United States Supreme Court, and I don't know of any case in where a defendant who is being interrogated on a murder charge or any other is told he cannot have counsel.
So do I understand then what you're saying is you concede that Miranda does not apply, but you believe there are other situations in which the Fifth Amendment right to counsel applies outside the courthouse, and this is one of them, but there's not yet any authority for that?
Okay. If he's in custody, the Miranda protections of warnings apply. Whether or not he's in custody, the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent is not a Miranda right, and it most definitely attached because the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent is applies anytime someone is subject to answering an incriminating question.
Do we have authority for that? Do we do? Okay.
Yeah, that's the Fifth Amendment? Yeah, sure. Here, does it quote, the protections of the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, Article 2, Section 18 of the Colorado Constitution can be invoked by anyone whose statements or answers to questions might incriminate that person, either by directly admitting the commission of illegal acts or by relating information that would furnish a link in the chain of evidence needed to prosecute the claimant for a crime. People versus Rosados, In re Galt, Hoffman versus...
I'm sorry, you were reading so quickly. Did you say the Colorado Constitution?
Yeah, both.
So, oh.
It's both. This is a quote from... That quote was from this court in Rosados, but...
So you weren't arguing that the Article 2, Section, whichever it is, goes beyond the protections of the Fifth Amendment there by citing the Colorado Constitution. You're saying they both would apply in this kind of situation, even though it's not a Miranda situation. Is that right?
If he's not in custody, I don't know what the court means by Miranda situation.
Wait. You just agreed, didn't you, that Miranda applies only if we have custodial interrogation. So I'm trying to decide if you're arguing that there is another Fifth Amendment right, where the Fifth Amendment is broader than Miranda outside of the courtroom.
Yes, I am. Okay. And I do not believe that the Miranda holding, the entire purpose of Miranda was to stop incommunicado interrogations. But where you're asking me, will I go further and ask this court to do something under the Colorado Constitution that's not recognized under the United States Constitution? I believe it is recognized under the United States Constitution, but would I ask for that if it wasn't? Oh, yes, I would. I believe very firmly this court has a duty to stop this type of action. And for example, in Miranda v. Burbine, not an issue in this case, the court there with a different type of issue stated it will leave it to the individual states to decide under their own constitutions whether additional measures are necessary given their more awareness of the type of police tactics going on in those states.
Ms. Bryan,
please.
Do you mind? I just wanted to check one quick fact. So it was always said to the defendant that you don't have a right to counsel, that there was never a differentiation. You don't have a right to appointed counsel.
Absolutely. And the officer's very clear that he was trying to secure both. I'm going to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Adams. My registration number is 31044, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. I would like to begin by addressing the custody issue because that really is the threshold issue in this case. Now, to determine custody, we have to look at the totality of the circumstances. And then we have to determine not whether the defendant felt that he was free to leave, but whether he would consider himself to be deprived of his freedom of action to a degree associated with a formal arrest. Now, in this case, the trial court made numerous findings of fact based on the record presented. The court found that the officer's testimony in this case was credible, and the court determined that the defendant was not in custody. The court found that the defendant was in the hospital being treated for a medical condition.
Sam, can I just ask you, I noticed that too, that just confused me. Is there some issue of credibility in terms of the testimony? I'm not questioning the finding.
No, I don't believe so.
Did anybody testify differently than what the police officers testified to?
No, there may have been a few dissimilar statements, but for the most part, all of the testimony was consistent at the hearing.
Thank you.
So the defendant was in the hospital for medical treatment, He was medically unable to leave the hospital. So while he was hooked up to an IV in this case, that was due to his medical condition. It was not any restraint that was put on him by the officers in this case.
What's the purpose of them being there?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What is the purpose of the officers being there 24 hours a day for 3 days?
The officer testified that he was there to check on the defendant's status. So if there was any change,
whether he was going to leave the hospital?
If he was going to leave the hospital. There was an eviction notice at the defendant's home. They didn't know where he was going to go after this. And the trial court found that while the defendant did have this officer outside of his hospital room during the time that he was in the hospital, that that officer did not contact the defendant, did not enter his room, and that the officer's role was not to prevent the defendant from leaving the hospital. And while that officer thought, or at least testified, that it was possible that the defendant might have been able to see him from his room, certainly that officer does not know what the defendant was able to see from his bed inside the hospital room, because he never entered that room.
Well, the families, or some of the families, going in and out of the room?
The family was going in and out of the room.
Surely they've told him that the police are here?
None of that was presented at the suppression hearing, so I don't know what the defendant's family told him about the officer's presence at the hospital.
You're saying he was basically unaware, though, that the police were out?
I'm saying that the record doesn't support a finding that he was aware that the officer was there. He was stationed by the nurse's station. We don't know that he even knew that he was there for him. I mean, there was an officer stationed outside of his room. Whether or not that was visible to the defendant, or whether or not he was advised of that by his family members, that's not part of the suppression hearing, and we don't have any records.
Certainly when they come and start questioning him and they're close to him, there are two of them armed officers, right?
They are plainclothed officers, and so by virtue of the fact that they are officers, they are armed, but there was no evidence that the weapon was visible to the defendant while he was in the hospital room. Additionally, the trial court found that there were no threats made by the officers, that the officers used a conversational tone throughout the interrogation. They were polite. The defendant greeted them on a first-name basis. There was no intimidation, and again, the officers did not brandish a weapon at any time. These findings made by the trial court are all supported by the investigator's testimony at the suppression hearing. And again, this room had a glass wall. While there were curtains, they were at least partially open. There were no directions given to the defendant at any time during this interrogation. There were no restraints placed upon the defendant by the officers. The officers, while they sat in the chairs that were in the room, there is nothing to suggest that they moved the chairs in such a way as to block the entrance to the room. It simply, they stated that they came into the room, and one officer sat in the chair that was situated by the defendant's head at the head of the bed. The other one sat in a chair that was situated at the foot of the bed. So there's nothing to indicate that they were in any way trying to block his access.
He couldn't get out in any event, right?
He couldn't, but again, that was due to his medical condition and not due to any action on the part of the officers.
But the police officers knew that he couldn't leave.
Well, again, I'm not sure how much information they had about his medical condition or
whether
or not.
Could they see that he was hooked up to the machine?
He was hooked up to an IV. That's the only information we have. Whether or not there were other monitors, that's just simply not in the record. The defendant, again, this interview was about 30 to 60 minutes. The defendant had just finished visiting with family at the time that this occurred. He was awake. He was responsive. He was coherent. There are just no factors in this case that indicate that this was a custodial interrogation. And, sorry, I was anticipating a question.
I'll ask you one since you're anticipating.
All right.
How would you characterize it? What kind of interrogation was this? How would you characterize it based on the evidence or the facts that you've just related?
As a non-custodial interrogation.
Just in the absence of custody, period?
Yes, non-custodial interrogation.
A voluntary interrogation or what?
Well, that is an issue raised on appeal as well.
I understand. I'm not talking about voluntariness in the true Fifth Amendment sense. I'm just using it in terms of the custody.
Yes, I mean, the defendant did say that he wanted to talk with an attorney prior to speaking with the officers. But again, if this court determines that there was no custody here, then they were not required to scrupulously honor the invocation of this right.
I don't understand that, because it seems to me that if he repeatedly and the family repeatedly said he wants to have an attorney here, it's certainly a misrepresentation by an officer of the court who's acting in sort of an investigatory capacity. I assume he's there at the hospital with the police, that there's no right to an attorney. Now, this is absolutely shocking to me. I mean, Everybody has the right to obtain an attorney when they have a legal problem. He's got his lifetime of incarceration possibly in front of him, and who knows what the death penalty and so on. We have an officer of the court relating to the police. They should tell him that there's no right to an attorney.
Right, well, that's not...
Are those the facts, or aren't they the facts?
Well, that's actually not the facts, Your Honor.
Okay, well, let's hear what they are.
First of all, the investigators contacted the district attorney to ask whether or not they could talk to this defendant, whether he was in custody, whether he was entitled to Miranda rights, and whether or not they could talk to him without an attorney present. The district attorney never instructed them to go back to the defendant and repeat this to him. They merely said, he's not in custody, you can talk to him without an attorney being present. He's not entitled to his Miranda rights at this point.
So you're saying that the district attorney did not say, ignore his, if he asked for a lawyer, ignore it, or something to that effect?
No, he did not say that to them. Now, again, I would argue that it doesn't matter. If he's not in custody, it doesn't matter if he invokes his right to counsel, and they absolutely can ignore that and continue questioning him.
To follow up on that line, if you're walking down the street and a police officer says, may I talk to you, and you say no and keep walking, isn't that supposed to be the end of it?
Absolutely.
Can the police officer follow after you and say, well, I only have 15 questions or something like that?
He certainly can. He can follow after you and say, you know, I just have a few questions. Can I just have a few minutes of your time? Or in this case, you can say, well, all right, you don't want to talk about that, but can I talk to you about these other issues? How do you feel about that?
And it should the court pay any attention to the fact that he's physically unable to get up and walk away?
Well, again, I don't know that he was physically unable to get up and walk away.
But you told us that he was in a hospital bed with an IV.
Plenty of times people walk around with an IV. And again, that's just not part of the record. But the Supreme Court has never held that a person can invoke his Miranda rights outside of a custodial interrogation context.
Well, we aren't talking necessarily about Miranda rights, are we? We're talking about him saying he wants to consult an attorney.
Well, and he certainly can consult an attorney, and he certainly doesn't have to talk to the officers. But the officers' attempts to persuade him to talk to them...
But what did they... Just tell us straight, since I haven't read the record, you have. What did the officers say the district attorney for the district told them?
He said that you are not under arrest, you are not in any type of legal custody, you have not been charged with a crime, and that therefore, in my belief, he is not entitled to an attorney.
What did the police tell?
That's what the police said.
That's all they said?
Yeah, that's what they said. And then there was a subsequent comment later where he said he was not entitled to an attorney at that time. That's what they said. Again, we don't have a videotape of this interview, so this is just from the testimony of the officers at the suppression hearing. But basically what the officers told him was, you are not in custody, you are not under arrest, you have not been charged with any crime, therefore you are not entitled to an attorney at this time.
Is that correct? Is that correct?
That is correct.
The United States citizens are not entitled to consult to an attorney before they go ahead and answer questions.
Well, of course, anyone can go out at any point in time and hire an attorney, and there was nothing to say that he couldn't do that here. All the officers were telling him was, at this time, we're talking about a non-custodial interrogation, he does not have the right to presence of an attorney at this interrogation.
Is there any indication in the record that they did anything to impede his ability to get counsel?
No. And in fact, I believe one of the investigators had provided some information to the defendant's daughter about ways in which to obtain counsel. But the purpose of the Miranda advisement is to protect against the compelling atmosphere of, again, a custodial interrogation. If we don't have a custodial interrogation, the protections that Miranda is designed to guard against don't exist. So in this case, where we're dealing with a non-custodial interrogation, the defendant doesn't have to be advised that he has the right to the presence of an attorney during the interrogation. And in fact, he doesn't have the right to the presence of an attorney during an interrogation that is non-custodial.
What does that mean exactly? I mean, you said he certainly can talk to an attorney. You said he certainly can remain silent.
Absolutely.
But I gather you're saying he may have the ability to do that, but you are still saying he doesn't have the right to do that. Or are you instead saying he does have those rights, It's just that there's no requirement that they be scrupulously honored in some fashion to invoke them. He has to continue to invoke them. That is, he has to remain silent, or he has to go get his lawyer.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. He does have to remain silent.
So you recognize the rights.
Well, we do live in a free country, and absolutely we can go out and hire attorneys at any point that we feel it's necessary. And we can tell the police.
So is that a recognition of a constitutional right?
Well, I'm not sure that it rises to the level of a constitutional right. I suppose we always do have the right to consult with an attorney, and we always do have the right to remain silent. Whether or not our subsequent statements need to be suppressed when those rights are not scrupulously honored, that's an entirely different question.
What kind of rights are they if they are constitutional?
Well, I guess my point is simply that when you're dealing with a non-custodial interrogation, which is what we have here, while the defendant certainly had those rights, the officers do not have any obligation to stop questioning him, wait for him to get an attorney, invite the attorney to sit in on the interrogation. None of that is required in a non-custodial setting.
Ms. Adams, does the fact that, let's assume your argument is so far we don't have a custodial interrogation, but then the officers say, you have no right to consult an attorney.
At this time.
Does that fact in any way impact the determination of whether or not this now becomes custodial?
No, I don't believe so.
Why not?
I think, again, that is one factor that possibly the court could consider. But again, when we look at custody, we have to look at the totality of the circumstances. And all of the circumstances in this case do not lead to a conclusion that this was a custodial interrogation.
And you... I looked at the trial court's ruling, and that's really dealt with later about the question about the attorneys. But
right.
If you throw that in as a factor, I don't quite understand. It seems to me that given what you're saying,
I think
a reasonable person wouldn't think that this was comparable to a formal arrest. The fact that he's told pretty affirmatively you have no right to an attorney, would seem to augur that we are now in custodial.
Well, and again, when you look at the context of what was said by the officer to the defendant, he was talking about Miranda rights. He was talking about you're not in custody. He was talking about, you know, you haven't been charged with a crime, so the Sixth Amendment isn't implicated either. And then he goes on to say, so because of that, you're not entitled to an attorney. I think what he's really getting at is you're not entitled to your Miranda rights in this situation.
Well, but that's why I asked the question I did. I mean, he didn't make those kinds of distinctions, did he? At least according to the record, he just seemed to say, not with any of this nuance, you don't get an attorney and I'm going to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, isn't that the state of the record? He said that twice.
And at most, I think that may be slightly ambiguous, but the words
that we're going to read in the record are simply those, are they not?
That you are not entitled to an attorney at this time. And
at this time
refers to the non-custodial interrogation.
Well, it doesn't refer to anything except for now we're here and we're going to talk to you and you're not entitled to an attorney.
And what's going on at that time is a non-custodial interrogation.
Well, we know that, and maybe others do, but... we're not even sure whether it was non-custodial or not, but did the defendant, was he being told this is not a Miranda situation?
Well, he was told he was not in custody, that he had not been charged with a crime, and that he was not under arrest. So, in essence, he was.
And then he said something like, well, I think I'm going to get an attorney, and then the officer said, well, you're not entitled to one, and so we're going to go forward. We're not going to wait for you to get an attorney.
No, at the beginning of the interrogation, the defendant said, I'd like to get an attorney before I speak to you. At that point, one of the officers said, well, can I talk to you about your property and the disposition of your property at the house and your medical status? At the end of that, that's when Officer Sheets explained to the defendant that he was not in custody, was not under arrest, had not been charged with a crime, and was therefore not entitled to an attorney at that time. He then went on to say, I'm going to explain to you the evidence that I have and what my theories are and what occurred, and I'm not going to ask you any questions, but here's what I think happened. And then he goes through all of that.
He didn't. The officer didn't tell him he was free to leave at any time, did he? Or if you don't want to talk to us, we'll stop talking to you, something like that?
He did not say, he didn't say anything other than you're not in custody, you haven't been arrested, you haven't been charged with a crime.
I'm wondering what that would mean to somebody in the defendant's situation. What do you think, since we have these very esoteric ideas of what custody is? How do you think that's interpreted by a person in the defendant's situation?
Well, I think the defendant certainly could have said, I don't want to talk to you. He could have continued to say, I want an attorney before I'm going to say anything.
But he did, didn't he? And, I mean, that's in fact the state of the record. He says, I don't want to talk to you. And he says, I want an attorney. My daughter is trying to give me an attorney.
He said that at the beginning of...
The police went on, and then if I understand it correctly, he repeated that. And then they said, well, you're not entitled to one, so we're going to talk to you anyway about these other things, but they circled back and talked to him about the crime.
Okay, he did not repeat that. He said that at the beginning of that day. He had said it on the previous day when they had come by to see him. He said, you know, I'm not willing to talk to you right now, but I might be willing to talk to you later. They waited 24 hours, came back on the 3rd, which is the interrogation where he made these statements. At the beginning of that, the officers explained that they wanted to talk to him and see what his version of events were. At that point, he said he'd prefer to speak to an attorney first so he wouldn't worsen the situation. That was the only comment that he made about an attorney during that interrogation. The defendant didn't again say, I'm still not going to talk to you, or I still want to go get a lawyer, or anything.
Isn't a plain implication, I want to talk to an attorney first, a plain implication that I want to talk to you? And it seems to me, isn't the standard one where we have to, as a matter of law, taking into account the totality of the circumstance, decide in effect whether this is a coerced confession?
Well, certainly we have to look at whether or not this was a coerced...
You keep saying it's, you know, an uncoerced confession, but would you agree that the standard is that we get to evaluate the totality of the circumstances in making that conclusion? Is that the standard or isn't it?
Well, the trial court gets to make the findings of fact, and assuming those are supported by the record, those are entitled to deference, and then this court makes a legal determination about whether or not those factors support a finding of custody. But the problem here is that in this case, while he said, I want an attorney, he wasn't in custody. Therefore, the officers did not have to scrupulously honor his invocation of the right to counsel, and they were able to continue talking to him. Now, there might be...
I think that's maybe well and true, but what makes this case so different is they went the one step further and said, but you can't have one now. I mean, that's a very affirmative statement, which I think someone who's not trained in the law might say, oh, maybe I misunderstood. I don't get attorneys now. Even though I really want one, they get to go ahead and talk to me now. And that's the part that concerns me that you seem to not be addressing directly. That affirmative statement that you can't have one.
Well, you're not entitled to one at a non-custodial interrogation.
But they didn't say, this is not custodial. Miranda hasn't attached, therefore I'm under no obligation to provide you with an attorney if you can't afford one. They said, if I understand from the record, you cannot have an attorney, right?
They said you cannot have an attorney, or you are not entitled to an attorney at this time. But that was immediately following their statements where they said, you are not in custody, you have not been charged with a crime, you are not under arrest, and therefore you are not entitled to an attorney at this time.
I understand your point that they merely told him Miranda rights don't attach is how that should be interpreted. But for a moment, could you address the circumstance that is instead regarded as they incorrectly told him he didn't have the right to an attorney, which I believe you have indicated you think that he did. So if they gave him that misinformation, how does that play into the analysis? Is it just one factor to consider in making the decision about whether the custody circumstance changed if we were to agree with you that he was not previously in custody? Is it just one factor to consider in voluntariness? Or what? How does that play?
Yes, I believe it would be a factor for the court to consider in determining whether or not the statements were voluntary or whether or not the defendant was in custody at the time. Certainly, I can imagine a situation where the statements might not be voluntary if he had, for example, repeatedly said that he wanted an attorney and they were badgering him in such a way that made his statements involuntary. Certainly here, that's not what we have. We have an entire interrogation that was conversational. They used a polite tone. It was not accusatory. I mean, the entire circumstances surrounding the interrogation don't lead to a finding of either custody or involuntariness.
What about the fact that, I understand this is contested, that the officer testified that he may have told the defendant that the prosecutor's office told him he wasn't entitled to an attorney. So now he's telling him there's a prosecutor involved in all of this. It's not just the police officers. And they're saying that you're not involved. You're not entitled to an attorney. What difference does that make in terms of voluntariness?
Well, again, I think that, again, we look at the totality of the circumstances in making that determination. But, you know, I think when you take the context of what the officer said and the way in which it was said, they're talking about you're not in custody, so you're not entitled to all of the rights that flow with custody. Those aren't applicable at this time. They're not saying he can't ever have an attorney. They're not saying that down the road he would be entitled to these rights. They're saying at this time, at the current place that we're in.
This is the crucial time. They're trying to extract a confession from him and make the prosecution's proof easy by a self-confession. So what, if not this time, when? When does the constitutional right get honored by the
state?
When
he's in custody.
Only in...
Well, or, I mean, there are a variety of situations, but not in a non-custodial interrogation.
He's in a hospital room, hooked up to an IV with 24-hour watch around him in a weakened condition, totally traumatized by the fact of the death of his two loved ones and the failure of himself to kill himself. And meanwhile, the state's trying to get the confession while he's in his most vulnerable position. Isn't that what we're looking at?
Well, again, the testimony was the defendant was responsive, he was coherent, he was awake, he was behaving normally, and the fact that they were trying to persuade him in order to get a confession does not equate with a finding that there was coercion on the part of the officers.
It's the circumstances I'm suggesting. Isn't that what we're supposed to look at, the totality of the circumstances?
Yes, but even a clear statement from an officer that this suspect is the this person being interrogated is the prime suspect, that's not enough to find that there's custody. We have to look at everything all together and determine whether, based on the totality of the circumstances, we have a custodial situation.
Can I ask a sort of a hypothetical, just to set a boundary? Not suggesting this happened here, but you would concede, I take it, that there would be some kind of a problem. We can argue about how you would characterize it if they had said, we're not going to allow you to talk to an attorney. They apparently clearly did not say that.
Mm-hmm.
If that were the situation, would you say then, what, no matter what they said, that he is in custody because he's being, they're keeping an attorney from him?
Well, again,
I guess it seems to me the question we're all dancing around here is, at what point does what they did say get too close to being like, you're not going to be allowed an attorney?
Well, and again, you know, those are not the facts that we're presented with here. And I think that at some point, yes, that probably would cross the line. I'm not sure what point that would be. And with all of these cases where we're talking about custody and voluntariness and we're looking at the totality of the circumstances, we're never going to find a case that's exactly on point or has all of the same factors that we have in this case. And so we have to just look at the factors that we have here. And when we look at what the officers told the defendant and what was going on in that room at that time, that's what we have to focus on. And at that point, they had told him he wasn't in custody. And their comment about his rights was related to that. It followed directly from that. And while the defendant doesn't have an obligation to come forward, there's nothing to indicate that he was in any way confused or thought that he could not get an attorney after that.
So do I understand the thrust of what you're saying is, given what they did say, all total, nobody would have taken that to
it's mean not reasonable.
We won't allow you to have an attorney.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can I just go back to one other question, getting off this attorney, but you take the position that he was free to leave, and I'm just looking at a review of Officer Antia's testimony.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of your comment.
Yes, I'm switching to a slightly different area,
okay.
Please. And I want to refer you to Officer Antia's testimony, and the question goes to whether he was free to leave, the defendant was free to leave, and Officer Antia seems to be saying that it was his job to make sure that he didn't leave the area.
That was his original statement. When questioned further, he said that, you know, that was not his job, was to make sure that he stayed there. And if he could leave, you know, certainly he could. But again,
well, and it says, and you were supposed to make sure that he didn't leave the areas in that right. And then he says, well, I suppose if he could get up, he could leave. But we do know now that he couldn't get up.
But again, that's not relevant to a determination of custody unless the defendant is aware of that. If the defendant is aware that this officer is keeping him there and preventing him from leaving, then that might be relevant to whether or not he felt that there had been a restriction placed on his movement. But what this officer's subjective thoughts were about what his job were are irrelevant to the determination unless they were in some way conveyed to the defendant. If the court has no further questions, I would ask this court to affirm.
Justice Hobbs, what happened in this case, or in all justices, is absolutely repugnant to our system of justice in this country. I would like to tender these few pages because the statement of facts as presented by the Attorney General is incorrect. The officers both testified that they told Mr. Eflin, when he said he wanted a lawyer, that they had spoken with the 18th Judicial District Attorney's Office, and he was not entitled to an attorney based on advice from that office. Can I give these to you? I think you should have these. They both testify that. The only dispute was whether or not the officer didn't remember if he used Dan May's name. But both were very, very clear. They said they consulted the district attorney's office based on his advice. Mr. Eflin was not entitled to counsel, and they were going to proceed with the interrogation. This flies in the face of centuries of cases trying to stop and prevent incommunicado interrogations in a police-dominated atmosphere. The word entitled, Justice Reyes, if you do it through a thesaurus and or run it with synonyms. Allow is a synonym. Permitted is a synonym. Authorized is a synonym. They are words meaning the same thing or having nearly the same meaning. And the only reason people are saying otherwise here is because lawyers are attaching legal significance to the term to mean you're not entitled to free counsel until charges are filed. But no one told that to Mr. Eflin, and on top of that, no one ever mentioned Miranda or anything about Miranda to Mr. Eflin. Mr. Eflin, in his weakened condition, tried and did what he could to stop that interrogation. He said repeatedly he did not want to talk to those officers, and he asked to have an attorney present before he did. Rather than complying with that, this is not scrupulously honor case. This will be called the blatantly ignore case and go further than blatantly ignore, actually and affirmatively tell him he's not entitled to counsel. And there is no case in this nation in which an officer has said that based on advice of the district attorney or otherwise, a person being interrogated on a first-degree murder charge is not entitled to legal representation. I ask you to reverse the Court of Appeals opinion.
Brian, I would ask you if you want to submit a supplemental authority to file something, and we'll allow the...
Oh, yeah, this was just pages from the transcript where they are referring...
If you want us to look at it, file it as a supplemental, and we'll give time for the Attorney General...
Your Honor, they're quoted in the brief.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted.